United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization presents The Silk Road Story, Part 1. The legendary Silk Roads over land and sea were above all a means of communication and dialogue between civilizations. The land route spanning two continents, from Xi'an, the ancient Chinese capital, to Roman Venice, is probably the oldest in the world. It has served for over 2,000 years to transport goods, ideas, missionary zeal, and marauding armies. Under its now tarred and metal surface lie buried many secrets of our past. The sea route, which came into existence much later, connected Roman Venice to China through India and Sri Lanka, going up to Nara in Japan. Although the Silk Roads have been the subject over the years of various individual studies by archaeologists, sociologists, historians, geographers, demographers, or maritime specialists, there has as yet been no systematic interdisciplinary examination of this vast repository of human history. UNESCO proposes to do this now with what it calls the Integral Study of the Silk Roads. Among the activities planned, there will be a research expedition retracing the main route across the Central Asian steppes, an itinerary which has never before been followed in its entirety by contemporary scholars. The caravan will link Rostov with Xi'an, China's ancient capital. International seminars will be held at historic sites along the way, focusing on the historic interaction of different cultures. Two subsequent expeditions are planned. One will go from the Chinese capital Beijing to Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia across the Gobi Desert, and the other from Odessa to Baku on the Caspian Sea. There will also be a major maritime expedition from Venice to Osaka, due to last at least 3 months. Some 30 associated projects are in the works, including a journey on an ancient Chinese junk to retrace Marco Polo's homeward voyage, and an equestrian caravan across the Soviet steppes. Over the next 5 years, the Silk Roads project, a major contribution by UNESCO to the World Decade for Cultural Development, will involve more than 1,000 experts of many nationalities and academic disciplines, working in close cooperation with the more than 30 countries situated along the old Silk Road. The ultimate aim is to make people today aware of the need for a renewed dialogue through the rediscovery of a historical record of human understanding which enriched civilization all along these roads. In this program, Vaidya Mahindra talks to Dr. John Thompson of the Royal Asiatic Society in London. She asked him what comes to his mind when he thinks of the Silk Road.
Well, I think of the Silk Road in quite conventional terms as the overland route between China through the Tarim Basin, through the Aral Basin, through Iran, Iraq, through Syria, and on to Rome. That is really the original Silk Route, and the overland route is at the heart of it all. I think of incredibly barren, difficult terrain, deserts of gravel, sand, dust, with a train of camels carrying valuable goods, both from east to west and from west to east. It must never be forgotten that just as foot came to the west, the Romans produced glass, which was very popular in China until the Chinese discovered how to make it. The route exists for geographical reasons, and it came into existence in a big way only in the 1st century BC when the Chinese conquered the Tarim Basin and for the first time discovered that there existed another culture far to the west. Once this connection had been made, of course, the route was open for trade, and it became very important for trade, and of course wars were fought over it, and there was a great deal of riches involved in this trade. But once the route existed, then, like any other highway, things travel along it in both directions. Not only is it a trade route, but it's a highway for the transfer of culture, religion, technology, and so on.
You brought up some interesting points. The first being silk itself. Could you go into that a little bit?
Let me talk about the Silk Road. Again, we are primarily talking about silk, at least in the first instance. And here, it's not really very well understood that the Romans knew about silk. They had their own silk production, but it was a production using wild silk, which wasn't very special. And in about the 1st century BC, the first imports of Chinese silk really came to the attention of the Romans. And this silk was an absolute knockout. It was much more transparent, it was much more alluring, it had a wonderful texture, it had a drape, it had a quality all of its own. And so wonderful was this silk for the Romans, who were already a culture geared to conspicuous consumption, that their own silk production vanished overnight. And the old-fashioned bombyx, as it was called, disappeared altogether. And instead, their attention was caught by this new material, which they called silica, because it came from the land of the Syrians, or so it is thought. Well, we don't actually know what that word means. They thought that the Syrians was somewhere just beyond the mountains, which indeed it was, but it was a very long way beyond the mountains, and the Syrians, as we now know, was actually China. And what the Chinese had discovered, and they discovered this a very long time ago, back in the New Stone Age, was how to unwind a silk cocoon as a single filament, which can be up to 1 kilometer long.
What is the size, the normal size of a cocoon?
Well, it depends whether you're talking about wild silk or cultivated silk, but the cultivated silk is about 1.5 centimeters long.
And it becomes about 1 kilometer long?
Up to 1 kilometer long, maybe less, maybe more. And if you unravel several threads together, then you can make an unbroken filament, a yarn, which produces a very, very sheer textile. In other words, that you can almost see through it. And this was the discovery that the Chinese made and kept to themselves from maybe 2000 BC, or maybe earlier, right up to the maybe the 7th century, or 6th century, when the secret leaked out to the West.
You mean to say it was intentional?
Yes, it was. Early on, silk was to be worn only by royalty. And it was considered to be the property of royalty alone. But in these early days, there were very few royal people. In the course of time, China developed into a great number of small feuding states, each with their own royalty. And of course, to accommodate this, the silk production gradually expanded. Well, when these families were finally reduced in number by gradual conquest, the domination of one family over another, the number of states shrank, and likewise, the number of people who wore it expanded. In fact, silk became practically universal. It was worn by practically everybody, and it became currency. People were paid in silk, and so on. It became the universal currency in Chinese culture.
What happened then between the Romans and the Chinese?
Well, the Romans, as I explained to you, were mightily impressed by this new kind of silk, which they didn't know where it came from. But they didn't like very much the Chinese patterns. And there's some evidence that they took the silk garments apart and they rewove them to their own specifications, using their own weaving techniques. So instead of exporting silk cloth, as many people imagine, what actually travelled along the Silk Route was raw silk, which is otherwise known as real silk, the unwound filaments. You wind the silk from the cocoon onto a large wheel, which is known as a reel. And in other words, it's the filaments of unbroken, undyed silk that were transported across the Silk Road or Silk Route. And the Romans, at least not the Romans, but actually in Syria and Iran, these were woven up into textiles which were then sold on to, first of all, Rome and then later to the Byzantium. In the first instance, when silk arrived in the West, the weaving technology was geared to wool and linen. And they used a particular kind of loom in which the textile is patterned using the horizontal transverse fibers, which are called the weft. These are quite suitable for wool and linen. And when silk arrived, they adapted their weaving technology to the new material. And in the process of doing it, so it is believed, they invented a system for making repeat patterns that can be woven simultaneously throughout the entire width of the fabric using a special device known as the draw loom. Now, this was actually a major breakthrough in weaving technology. And there still is a matter of great dispute as to where this invention was made and exactly when. Current thinking is that it was made in either Syria or Iran sometime between the 3rd and 7th century AD. There are other views which believe that it was made in China and that it spread westwards, but on the basis of the available evidence, it seems that it was made in the West and actually spread backwards along the Silk Road until it came to China. There are various reasons for thinking this. It's a very strange thing that some of the most wonderful textiles that come out of Tang China, that is from the 7th century onwards, actually are patterns with Persian designs, which are known to have originated in Sasanian Persia. And these designs consist of a roundel, in other words, a circular device, which has what's called a pearl border. In other words, the border is patterned with small circles. And inside this roundel are pictures of birds or animals or horses, decorated in a particular way which is quite characteristically Iranian. Now, why would it be that Chinese weavers were copying Iranian designs? Well, the obvious suggestion is that Iranian textiles were in high fashion. In other words, they were the best. So why not copy the best? There are other interesting clues to the fact that the Iranians got ahead in their weaving technology. For example, they have been excavated from the Tarim Basin, in other words, from the sands along the Silk Route, a number of silk textiles which have Sasanian Persian designs, but are actually woven not on a draw loom, but on the old-fashioned Chinese pattern rod loom, which suggests that they were trying to imitate something in fashion using their own existing technology. Now, I think the answer to these questions actually lies buried in the sands of the Silk Route, and I'm very keen to get to the bottom of it.
What else took place on the Silk Route? I mean, we're talking about a particular period now. If one were to go a little further up in history and come closer to the present time.
Yes. Political events had a very important consequence here. Two things happened. First of all, there was the Arab conquest, which spread northwards in terms of the Silk Route through Iran and into Central Asia and finally into the Tarim Basin during the 8th century. And at the same time as the conquest of the Arabs across the land, they became quite adventurous in opening up the sea routes, using the prevailing winds which would take them eastwards to India and finally further east via Ceylon to China that way. Also, another event that occurred was the moving of Turkic peoples into the Tarim Basin. These were nomadic people who gradually conquered the whole area and settled and displaced, or rather replaced, the Iranian language, which was at one time spoken throughout the Tarim Basin, with the Turkic language. And, of course, they were very keen to take the valuable and lucrative trade route away from the Chinese, which they did quite successfully. And in fact, the Chinese control of the Tarim Basin wasn't thereafter recovered until the 18th century. So as a result of the political and military changes, conquests and so on, the overland route gradually became more problematic and less important in terms of transporting silk. Also, what happened was that after the Tang period, you have the increase in importance of Chinese porcelain as a commodity, which we know very well was transported by sea, but it also came overland. And then we have a vitally important episode in the history of the region, and that is the Mongol conquest in the 12th century, which completely transformed the political equation in this region and reigned in Central Asia quite a substantial period of peace, which some people call the Pax Mongolica and other people call the Silence of the Graveyard.
One very small question. Is this the one and a half humped camel and the two humped camel? What is that all about?
Yes. What we always have to remember is that we, I think I can speak for you as well as myself, belong to what we might call the urban agricultural people. And historically, we have always sat inside our houses looking outwards slightly fearfully at these various nomadic incursions which have erupted throughout history. The one that we know best in Europe is the incursion of the Huns, of course. But there have been many others. And particularly in the history of this region, there is a constant dynamic interaction between the people who raised horses, sheep, camels, and cattle, and who moved according to the season to find pasture, and those people who stood in one place and either with the help of irrigation or with the help of natural rainfall planted seeds and grew crops in the same place. And this is a fundamental historical division. And I'm always unhappy to see the nomadic people left out, because the nomadic peoples supplied the settled peoples with animals, with hides, with leather, with wool, with felt, as well as with milk products. And they also, interestingly, developed certain forms of technology, particularly in terms of warfare, which made them invincible until the settled people learned how to use them. For example, there was the compound bow, which is a short bow made out of horn, tendon, and wood, which can shoot an arrow with equivalent power with only half the length of bow. And this was developed for shooting from the saddle. And the nomadic archers actually perfected the art of cavalry warfare by shooting from the saddle, at great speed, and they developed tremendous skill in this. They also developed a very long sword, which they could use on horseback. And really, the Chinese only got level with the nomads when they learned how to use these nomadic weapons, and when they adopted the cavalry tactics, as opposed to the infantry and chariot warfare, which they were used to. So, coming back to our 1.5-hump camels, the point that I was making was that the northern camel is the 2-humped Bactrian camel, and the southern camel, which lives in dry regions, is the 1-humped Arabian camel. And if you cross these two, you get a much stronger, more powerful animal that is capable of carrying much heavier loads than either. And it seems to me that this was the animal that was mainly used for transporting goods along this silk route in the early period. I think what happened was that although the wheel was invented very early on, the full potential of the wheel didn't really come until the Industrial Revolution in the West. The wheel early on was used in chariot warfare, which I think must have been a bit like the invention of the tank. When it was first used, it was found to be a very effective military weapon, but it soon became a rather slow-moving, expensive, heavy piece of plant, which the mounted cavalrymen could move much faster and much more maneuverable. So in warfare, the chariot was abandoned. Well, in terms of transport, a camel doesn't need a road. So although carts were known and used on the steppes from very early periods, actually when it comes to transporting goods, it wasn't the cart that was developed, it was the pack animal.
And therefore the development of all these caravans along the
route. Exactly, that's right. So that people, when they wanted to invest money in improving trade, they invested in bridges and caravans arrived and didn't bother with roads.
Vaidhu Mahindra was talking to Dr. John Carson of the Royal Asiatic Society in London. That was the first part of the Silk Road story, presented by Mahabulos and produced at UNESCO in Paris.